journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Clear all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, February 5th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
Silence is not an option.
A special focus on the U.S. economy, how the stimulus plan is coming under fire for one provision, why the Long Beach poverty rate has jumped, and a special in-studio conversation with Chris Hedges on why it's not going to be okay.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
I'm back after my vacation in Dubai, visiting family. Very grateful to my producer, Gabriel San Roman, for keeping the show together in my absence. Also extremely grateful to guest hosts Hamid Khan and Maria Armudian for sitting in for me. And believe it or not, our winter fun drive starts tomorrow, and as usual, we'll have a lot of exciting programming planned. Now onto our first story of the morning. As debate over President Obama's economic stimulus package turns to the Senate, more than 200 groups are calling for at least one provision in the bill to be removed. Last week, the Senate Appropriations Committee approved an amendment proposed by Republican Senator Robert F. Bennett calling for the allocation of $50 billion in federal loan guarantees for nuclear and so-called clean coal projects. In a letter dated Tuesday, environmental groups, small businesses, and concerned citizens urged senators to reconsider, saying that the inclusion of such a provision will prove to have no stimulative effect on the economy in the timeframe set out by the plan. If kept, the $50 billion would expand funding for technologies included in the Energy Policy Act of 2005. Detractors of the provision, which was not part of the House version of the economic stimulus package, say that most of the money will go to the construction of new nuclear and coal projects. Organizations such as the Natural Resources Defense Council, Friends of the Earth, and the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research cite estimates made by the Congressional Budget Office that say more than half of such loans would be at risk for default. My guest this morning is Michael Marriott, the Executive Director of Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Welcome to Uprising, Michael.
Good morning. How are you?
Now, how is it that the Senate Appropriations Committee was able to bring this, sneak this amendment in, if you will? And why do you think they did it? Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay, we're in business. Apologies to both you and our listeners for that. So as I was saying, the provision of $50 billion in Obama's economic stimulus package was inserted by the Senate Appropriations Committee. How exactly did the Senate Appropriations Committee manage to sneak it in? Was it, in fact, snuck in? And why did they do that?
Well, it was, in fact, snuck in. It was done late at night. They never took a vote on it. It was just sort of put in there. It's what's called a manager's amendment, and it was done at the urging of Senator Bennett of Utah, who, in quite a display of hypocrisy, the next morning announced he'd be voting against the bill anyway. So the leadership, our understanding is the leadership of both the Senate and the House, neither of them knew that this provision was going to be stuck in there. The problem is, of course, that once it's in there, it's hard to get it out.
And what exactly is it calling for? I mean, isn't it something that that renewable energy sources or renewable energy startups, rather, could also take advantage of? And if so, could it not be a good thing?
In theory, renewable energy sources could use this money. However, the language attached to the amendment, report language, made it clear that this is intended for the nuclear industry. And we know that because the nuclear industry is really the only industry that's taking or trying to take advantage of existing loan guarantees. There currently is about $20 billion authorized for nuclear power loan guarantees that the Department of Energy has not yet been able to spend, but the utilities, nuclear utilities, have asked for $122 billion in loan guarantees. So the language in the report makes note of the large number of applications in the pipeline. So it's very clearly aimed at the nuclear industry, and there have been statements made by various supporters of this that also make that clear. But I should point out, and I think you did in the introduction, this has no business being on a stimulus bill. This money will not be spent in a timely fashion because there are no nuclear reactors that will be licensed to build in the next 2 years. They're all going through the licensing review process now. It's a lengthy process. Most of these utilities want to use reactor designs that have not yet been approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, so they won't be approved in the next 2 years either. So there's no stimulative effect here, and the Department of Energy has not even been able to spend the money that it has now for nuclear loan guarantees.
So there was a lot of talk about this stimulus package really being aimed at the American worker and helping businesses stay afloat so that jobs can be preserved. There was a spirit, at least in theory and verbally, of having this package go through without lawmakers attaching their favorite incentives, if you will, to particularly sneaking them in at the last minute. So how is it that, I mean, is it just the committee that was at fault here? And how can this be undone? You said it was going to be difficult, but how can it be undone?
Well, this kind of thing is actually pretty rampant in the bill right now. You see a lot of senators withholding support for the bill until their pet projects get in there. That's causing the bill to increase in size, and it's a real problem. How it can get out, one thing that is hopeful is that the bill approved by the House of Representatives does not contain this language. And in fact, in the House Energy Committee deliberation on this bill, the committee explicitly voted not to include loan guarantees for nuclear power plants in the stimulus bill. So there will have to be reconciliation between the Senate and House versions. And
that's where it may get deleted out?
Well, that's where we're hoping, and that's where we're aiming our efforts. I mean, we're trying to, one thing is, because this was done in the dead of night, and I mean that literally, a lot of the senators don't really even know this is in there. We've been trying to educate them. We've generated more than 5,000 letters in the last 5 days to the Senate, and phone calls, and the group letter by 243 organizations was hand-delivered to the Senate yesterday. So we're trying to make them aware of it, but it's an uphill process. The Capitol Hill is a pretty chaotic place these days.
My guest is Michael Marriott, Executive Director of Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Let's talk about the nuclear industry in general and where it is in this moment when renewable energy technologies are making big gains and becoming much more of a reality. Is this sort of a last-ditch effort to boost this sagging industry?
Well, I think it is. The reality is that there's no private money available to build nuclear power plants. I mean, even before the credit crisis, the private investors thought nuclear power was too risky. And so that brings up the fundamental question here is, should we be using taxpayer money to build an established technology? Nuclear power has been around for 50, 60 years, and we're not talking about radically new reactor designs or anything. These are the same old pressurized water reactors and boiling water reactors we've had for decades that they're talking about building. So should we be using taxpayer money to build something that the private investment community has rejected on the grounds that it is simply not economic to do so?
Particularly at this time in the economic recession.
Well, exactly. When the Congressional Budget Office has predicted that there would be a 50% or more default rate among utilities using this program. So that's a lot of potential taxpayer money at risk.
And that's not even talking about safety issues and environmental hazards.
Well, sure. The nuclear industry has not solved the basic issues that caused its decline in the first place, the safety issues. There's no such thing as a meltdown-proof reactor at this point. The radioactive waste issues, it's in our view unconscionable for Congress to be considering putting up taxpayer money to create more radioactive waste in our communities when we don't have anywhere to put the waste we've already generated. And the only place that we've been looking at, which is Yucca Mountain, Nevada, is probably not going to happen now. The odds of that happening now, I'd put it less than 10%.
And also, what about liquid coal, which is the other industry that could benefit from this from this amendment to the bill?
Well, on the coal side, it has the same stimulative effect problems as the nuclear side. There aren't going to be any of these plants built in the next couple of years. But we also have to look at whether that is a good use of taxpayer money to support a technology which is possibly even more polluting than existing coal plants. I mean, because in this case, you know, coal to liquids, you're burning coal and then you're turning it into a fuel that's also going to be burned, and the carbon output of that kind of process is very high. And of course, the concept of sequestration, carbon capture and sequestration from coal plants, that's quite a ways down the road, and clearly not part of a stimulus package.
Now, in the letter that was written by and signed by several organizations, including yours, just a few days ago, another issue you bring up is that the Department of Energy is not ready to manage such an enormous loan guarantee program for $50 billion. Can you explain that a little further?
Well, sure. The Department of Energy is not a bank. And when you're dealing with a program this large, you know, you really need some banking and some investment expertise, and the Department of Energy just doesn't have that in place yet.
And the amendment calls for the DOE to manage these funds?
Yes, the DOE would be managing these funds. They'd be choosing the projects and giving out the money. And a little-known fact that I think even most senators don't understand yet is that, like I said, private capital is not going to be investing in this, and the Department of Energy recognizes that. And so their own rules require that if a utility uses the maximum amount allowed under the program, which is 80% of the project cost, we're not just guaranteeing that the loan will be paid back to Citibank or Bank of America or something. The money is actually going to come from the federal treasury. Taxpayers are going to give that money to the utilities and then promise that the taxpayers will pay it back if the utilities don't.
I mean, this is amazing. $50 billion is not a small amount at a time when American workers are suffering so deeply. What, if anything, has President Obama said about this amendment?
So far, nothing. And I don't know if it's on their radar screen or not. In fact, we're going to be later today flooding the White House with letters and comments to try to bring this to greater attention.
And is that something you recommend listeners do as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's a contact form at whitehouse.gov, and I would absolutely recommend that people contact their senators, House members, and the White House. And, in fact, you can do that from our website, www.nirs.org. But, you know, it's ironic. A couple months ago, we had a debate, a long national debate, controversial debate, over whether to spend $25 billion supporting the auto manufacturers who are responsible for a lot more jobs than nuclear power plants. Here, they're trying to avoid a debate on twice that amount of money put at risk.
Well, Michael, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and certainly listeners can find out more about this particular amendment to the economic stimulus package we've been talking about at your website, nirs.org, and also contact the White House if they disagree with it. Thank you again for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Marriott is Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Again, the website, nirs.org. Later in the hour, we will speak with a member of LANE, the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, about their new report on the poverty rate in the city of Long Beach. After this short break, Chris Hedges in studio to talk about the economy as well. Stay tuned.
Ladies and camelmen, I'd like to welcome y'all to the Middle East. Welcome. My name is Elmia. Elmia.
That's an angel. Just keep it as your precious gold. We keep it as
I'm talking to you.
where the camels roam. I'm from a place where they chill when the heat is on. Yeah, feel me, a bridge back tradition. I'm a product of youth contradiction. I don't cap or crack, just OD and rap. What the slick, this fact, I watch them react. Relax, while I tease you costly, yeah. I put the ether, then I give it back to you. I'm on time, I'm broke with no nine.
And that's a little music I brought back from my vacation in Dubai. Desert Heat, singing Keep It Desert. The Labor Department announced an unexpected jump in first-time claims for jobless benefits at the end of January. Initial unemployment claims increased by 35,000, the highest level in 26 years. The total number of people collecting jobless benefits has climbed to a record 4.79 million. According to veteran journalist and frequent Uprising guest Chris Hedges, quote, the daily bleeding of thousands of jobs will soon turn our economic crisis into a political crisis. Companies are laying workers off faster than expected in an attempt to survive the recession, but the growing controversy over excessive CEO pay and incentives, particularly those receiving government bailout money, has angered Americans. In response, President Barack Obama announced a salary cap for those companies yesterday as he struggles to make the case for his economic stimulus package. But, says Hedges, there is nothing President Obama can do to stop the downward economic decline, as it has been decades in the making. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, senior fellow at the Nation Institute currently, author of several books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, I Don't Believe in Atheists, and his latest, Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians. Welcome back to Uprising, Chris.
Thank you.
So I have to say, I got pretty depressed reading your article. It is a depressing scenario. And you lay it out pretty clearly that well before things are going to get better, they're going to get worse and a lot worse. How worse? What should we expect?
Well, I think all of the signs point to a period that will probably parallel the experience the country went through during the Great Depression, with a couple important and I think frightening differences. In the 1930s, we had powerful movements on the left, progressive forces, labor unions, an independent press. We didn't have a corporatized press that ranged, of course, from Hearst newspapers all the way to the Catholic Worker, and that's gone. And so I think that the counterforces to radical right-wing movements, and these movements always arise in times of economic turmoil and deprivation, are not going to have the impediments they had before. I of course, look at the radical Christian right in this country as not a religious movement but a mass movement with the and of course, the engine of all of these movements is despair, personal and economic despair. And as more and more Americans are not only thrust from their jobs but face being thrust from their homes, as we continue to funnel money upwards towards Wall Street and investment banks, the largest transference of wealth upwards in American history, we really set the stage for not only a very frightening economic decline, but a period of deep political dislocation.
Now, could some of this have been averted had those who were sounding the alarm, had they been listened to years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago even? And who are some of the people who are saying that this was in the making? And they, you know, certainly they want people at the Wall Street Journal printed.
Well, that's part of the problem. I mean, you touch on it, and it's an important part of the problem, because there were certainly voices. You know, let's just start with Ralph Nader, who were sidelined by the mainstream, and not just the mainstream press, but the mainstream political establishment, and, of course, the universities. People who had searing and, I think, in retrospect, correct critiques of unfettered capitalism and what it does to a society, of globalization, were just not given a hearing. In this article that you draw from on Truthdig, I quote Sheldon Wolin, who is one of the country's great political philosophers, without question, taught first at Berkeley and then at Princeton. And he has a new book that I highly recommend called Democracy Incorporated, where he talks about the specter of inverted totalitarianism and how the face of totalitarianism doesn't always rise in its classical form, but can come through essentially corporatism. And he, you know, even in publications like the New York Review of Books, and which you would think would cling to a kind of intellectual independence, he was essentially banished from the pages. So these voices in this giddy pursuit of wealth, which we now, you know it wasn't just Bernie Madoff, but was in essence a giant Ponzi scheme, were not given a hearing. And we are paying the price for essentially sidelining those people who offered powerful and important critiques of what was happening to our capitalist economy.
Do you foresee, Chris, that in the bleak future we face, and when I say we, I mean ordinary Americans, that those who enjoyed, who benefited from this irrational exuberance, if you will also suffer, or are they going to make off with our money?
Well, part of what's happened, both economically and politically, is that we have created an oligarchic class. And what you see with the stimulus package and the bailout is that oligarchic class protecting itself. And unfortunately, President Barack Obama has bought into this idea that sustaining a dysfunctional system, why, for instance, was AIG bailed out? Well, AIG was bailed out because Goldman Sachs had invested $20 billion in AIG. Where did that money go? What did AIG do? Well, in essence, in AIG provided insurance for large numbers of mortgages that bankers knew would go bad. And Goldman Sachs would have gone under because AIG would not have been able to pay out that money that Goldman Sachs had invested in the company, which is why Paulson got down on his knees, you know, a former chairman, CEO of Goldman Sachs, to beg Nancy Pelosi to pass the bailout. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's going on. Dennis Kucinich has been, you know, one out there, you know, pointing a lot of this out. And unless, you know, Obama, and, you know, he's certainly a very intelligent guy, unless he charts a radical course, unless there is a radical break from the status quo, and I'm not very optimistic given the fact that people like Larry Summers are now in the White House. I mean, Larry Summers is largely responsible through the destruction of Glass-Steagall, along with Robert Rubin and others, for creating, for essentially turning commercial banks into investment houses. So I think he doesn't have much time. And how are we responding? Well, you know, we're borrowing and we're printing money. You know, I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, and that war was not caused by ancient ethnic hatreds. It was caused by the physical or the economic meltdown of Yugoslavia. We know from past scenarios, I mean, going all the way back to Weimar, that when you start printing money like this, you really raise the possibility of frightening and very serious inflation. So the indicators are not good. This has been decades in the making. The destruction of the manufacturing class, the rise of global capitalism, where essentially you have a transnational oligarchic elite with no loyalty to any country, any nation, and who is essentially reducing the working class both within and beyond our borders to a kind of subsistence level. We sustained a standard of living through essentially borrowing. And a whole house of cards is coming down. I mean, you know, William Guider and others estimate that we probably have, you know, $4 to $6 trillion in worthless assets, and we just don't have enough money to throw at it.
Now the sustaining of our standards of living and the price we pay for that, is this part of the inverted totalitarianism that Sheldon Wolin talks about?
Yeah, I would disagree with Wolin there, you know, one does that with a great deal of humility. He's certainly a brilliant thinker. But Wolin's argument is that through what he calls inverted totalitarianism, you don't necessarily have a charismatic or a demagogue as a leader, but you create a political passivity by creating spectacle, you know, the vast entertainment industry out there, and also giving people a level of personal comfort or consumer products that keep them mollified. Well, that isn't going to work anymore. People don't have the disposable income anymore to go out and buy huge flat-screen TVs and SUVs and all the other sort of toys that in a consumer society I think did create political passivity. I worry very much that the Christian right, which has the organizing capacity that the left doesn't have through churches and megachurches dotted all around the country. And
which gives people community, a sense it gives, of community.
Yes, it gives people community. It gives people an authoritarian community. It's not a real community because the power centers of these megachurches, which function as small villages. I mean, I've been in many of the churches. I mean, there's literally restaurants with brunches and bowling alleys, and that's where the AA meets, and that's where childcare is, and that's where the woman's sewing club. I mean, it's what they've done is you've had a rise in a very rigid authoritarian community where the leaders of these churches, who are invariably male and white, are never allowed to be questioned because, of course, they are in direct contact with God. Any kind of questioning or self-criticism becomes a form of backsliding, is satanic. But the rise of these, let's call them faux communities, has come in conjunction with the destruction, the physical destruction of real community. That's what poverty does. When you go to the former manufacturing centers in Ohio, places like Youngstown, you see how these communities have been ripped apart. They don't exist physically, with all the attendant problems of domestic abuse, drug addiction, alcohol abuse, broken homes. Then the list is endless. So you're very right that what we have is people will be retreating into these Christian authoritarian enclaves because they have nowhere else to go. And the left has no, progressives or those of us who care about an open society, we have no alternative to offer.
My guest is Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, senior fellow at the Nation Institute. We're talking about a piece that he wrote recently for Truth Dig called It's Not Going to Be Okay. Now, linking this, what you just described earlier about how our standards of living have been, you know, propped up by this economy and we're not going to have the ability to buy these toys to keep us passive anymore. What about the U.S. empire? Literally, our men and women and our military bases abroad, how do you link the U.S.'s overarching empire, particularly as it expanded under Bush, with the failure of the U.S. economy and what you foresee may be happening?
Well, that's a crucial point. We spend, $650 billion a year in our military. According to the CIA, the second largest expenditure on a national military is China, with $65 billion. We've spent 10 times more. It's not a new story. Empires invariably hollow themselves out from the inside by constant military expansion until finally that expansion is unsustainable. That, again, is something the Obama administration has unfortunately decided to pursue, especially in Afghanistan. You cannot question the military expenditures, the fact that half of all discretionary spending by the federal government goes into the military. It used to be raised 20 years ago by Democrats who would at least fight certain weapon systems. You never hear that now. Wolin makes a very funny point. He said, we were sold this notion that government was bad, but somehow the military wasn't part of the government. We are crumbling internally, economically, and we are, and of course that's what empires do. They expand to the point where they there's an expansive quality to the empire finally overreaches itself, and that's what we've done. So there's a confluence of very dangerous forces at work here, and that is economic collapse coupled with a massive and unsustainable empire. And those two forces, when they converge, or as they are converging, will mean crisis.
Now, there are those who say that President Barack Obama has the worst job in the country, if not the world, today. You also have said that there's pretty much nothing he can do. But you also mentioned earlier that there is a radical course that could be pursued. What sort of radical course from the White House, at least? I mean, not even necessarily talking about from the bottom up just yet, but what sort of radical course could Barack Obama and his administration pursue that could ease the pain that we are going to all be feeling, or if not already feeling?
Well, I think looking back at, you know, as the New Deal as a model, nationalizing the banks, which they may be forced to do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Even John Kerry, who's hardly known as a political renegade, was saying calling a lot of the American banks zombie banks. You know, one of the terrifying things about the crisis is that the very people pulling the levers have no idea. They just don't know how much toxic debt they have. And one of the most disturbing things that we've seen in the last few days is that it's not just foreclosures. It's not just people who can't pay their mortgages, but now, of course, people who can't pay their credit card bills. I mean, it's not a surprise. That this is spreading to people who ostensibly have good credit ratings. So people just don't know. I mean, people within the financial system don't know. I think that, you know, in order for us to weather this crisis and salvage what is left of our open society, we really need a government that, rather than trying to mollify and prop up a broken financial system, one that, you know, by the laws of other periods in history and even other countries is criminal. I mean, people like George Soros in the 17th and 18th century would have been hung. That's what you did. Literally, it was a crime. I mean, that's what you did with speculators. You know, and that's what hedge fund managers are. And that's what these large concerns like AIG and Morgan Stanley became. I think for me the most disturbing part of the Obama administration is looking at who he has decided to surround himself with. The fact that you would allow Larry Summers to give you daily briefings on the economy when it was Larry Summers who actively orchestrated the destruction of the regulatory agencies and the walls that were meant to protect us from this it's nonsensical.
Chris, I want to talk a little bit now about what ordinary people could do. I mean, you bring up, of course, the very sort of terrifying reality that many Americans, because of the economic woes, are going to be drawn to the mega churches and be pulled into the Christian right wing. But there are, of course, other paths. And an optimist might say, well, this might be the moment that Americans may realize that real community is going to pull them through, where farmers' markets may flourish, where people may begin start to once more barter, and neighbors may help each other out and exchange goods. And, you know, maybe this is something that becomes that other inevitability. What do you think?
You're right. I mean, people will be forced into a kind of lifestyle which we should have voluntarily accepted some time ago. But what I fear is that as the economic situation becomes more untenable, we will see demonstrations, protests, but the power of the corporate state, which, and of course the rise of the corporate state always means the rise of the surveillance state, will see our oligarchic class essentially employ the very sophisticated techniques. I mean, we saw it at the Republican and Democratic convention.
Just the police state coming out in full force
and
quell civil unrest.
And it was, it was Orwellian in the forms of infiltration and electronic monitoring and absolute ruthlessness to make any counter-narrative heard. And, of course, we have a corporatized media, especially an electronic media, which rather than responsibly convey the concerns of those of people who are suffering and raise their voice in dissent, will do what they did to the anti-war movement after the invasion of Iraq, which is, if they ever give them a brief few seconds on the screen, is essentially ridicule and belittle them as outside, as somehow not American, as outside the mainstream. So, and Wolin, this is Wolin's concern, and I share it, that we may see vibrant resistance, although I think it will be localized, but the tools and the capacity of the corporate state to shut it down, and the utter refusal on the part of our corporatized media to give a voice to this movement. I mean, remember that Martin Luther King may have been all for nonviolence, but he often had National Guard troops lining the streets, and he had a media that amplified his voice and the voice of the civil rights movement throughout the country. Mm. When you live in totalitarian states and you have the capacity to muzzle dissent, and will employ ruthless mechanisms to contain or crush dissent, then you slip very quickly into despotism. Mm. And I think this has to be a very real possibility, and I think that there are, unfortunately, and we've seen it, we saw it over the summer, precedents that show that there is very, very little room to maneuver in this country anymore. Unless you stay within the very narrow parameters, that very narrow narrative that is handed to us by those in power.
And it is at a time like this, then, not to sound too self-serving, but an institution like Pacifica is so crucial to bring this out.
Of course.
Krista, finally, let me ask you what you recommend. In terms of, obviously, you're a writer, you're a journalist, you're an analyst, and you don't have all the answers, and you may not be wanting to offer all the answers or solutions. But any thoughts to listeners who, are frightened by what's to come, aside from, stay away from the mega church and don't believe that hype. But what else? What else can we do to, the line in your article that probably scared me the most was our children will never have the standard of living we had.
Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It isn't. Mm. A life dedicated towards consumption and personal hedonism is not necessarily healthy either for your body or your soul. So that doesn't frighten me. I think learning a certain humility and learning limitations, especially in a world where half of the population lives on less than $2 a day, is salutary for us as a nation. I think we have to walk out on the Democratic Party. I didn't vote for Obama. I voted for Nader. A lot of that had to do with the war. I think that the left has essentially rendered itself impotent by throwing in its lot with the Democratic Party, that over and over and over betrays the interests of the working and increasingly the middle class in this country. I mean, just look at the bailout. Constituent calls were running 100-1 against the bailout, and they pass it anyway. Why do they pass it? Because, lobbyists and corporate powers wanted it passed. The FISA Reform Act, which Barack Obama voted for, a giant step towards fascism. Why did it pass? Because the telecommunication companies spent $15 to $20 million in lobbying fees to make sure it got passed. The government at its core, and forget the rhetoric, forget the propaganda, forget, yes, we can, serves the interests of corporations. We are watching it now with the financial bailout. We are watching it in the absolute failure on the Democratic Party to challenge the rapacious cannibalization of the country by the military-industrial complex.
So just to bring that up then, do you mean supporting parties like the Green Party or building the other independent parties or even abandoning the electoral system in particularly at a time when the economic crisis is going to hit us and focusing on those issues of localism and really rebuilding our communities from the grassroots up?
Well, I suspect that progressive politics will begin locally rather than national. I mean, I love Ralph. He's a friend, and I think his voice is important. But I think it will begin locally. I think we somehow have this idea that these candidates who are selected for us by moneyed interests. You can't run for president unless corporations, you know, write the checks. And that somehow voting for this very limited spectrum is all we have to do. That's a very minor part and not even that an important part of what we do. So, yes, locally, I think we have to be willing to stand fast on issues and find within ourselves a new kind of militancy, because if we don't, the other militants, the militants who want to destroy all the things that we care about, plurality, openness, tolerance for other ways of being, I don't even like the word tolerance, an acceptance of other ways of being other than our own, all of this will vanish. Mm-hmm.
Well, Chris Hedges, as always, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, senior fellow at the Nation Institute. His latest book is Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians. You can also read the article we've been discussing today called It's Not Going to Be Okay at Truthdig. And, Chris, you have a website, too?
I don't, but I write every Monday for Truthdig.
Truthdig. All right. Well, that's the place to go. And we'll link to it from our website, kpfk.org/uprising, later today. Also, special thanks to Mansoor Sabag. You are listening to Uprising. And after this short break, we will turn to A Tale of Two Cities, the title of a new report about the city of Long Beach. Stay tuned. The city and Hijad, Fred Drag, Los Angeles, Cap, California, the Middle East represents. Well, it's the Mr. Pimp test against the lizard in the pimp's nest. Approach the scene, hands up like a witness. Kevin Hart, Jose Marco in Jeddah. Well, my man Frederick in LA with the scripture. MTV Arabia collaboration. Hip hop and the host exposing the Arab nation. So, who's qualified for this move but the two of us? So, get on the bus. Hey, the KSA was introduced to hip hop by the West Coast sound when Death Row's chronic album dropped. It was all about the gangster boogie from the Aqua Boogie. Whether you're pro or rookie, my man Tupac. And that's Saudi hip hop artist Kosai, aka Don Legend, with From Jeddah to LA, another one of the pieces I picked up on my vacation to Dubai. In a new report, the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, or LANE, found that taxpayer subsidies to the tourism industry in Long Beach have not yielded a fair return on the public's investment. The city has for nearly 30 years invested over $750 million in taxpayer subsidies in hopes of creating revenue and bringing new jobs to its residents. However, the report, A Tale of Two Cities, How Long Beach's Investment in Downtown Tourism Has Contributed to Poverty Next Door, finds that wages in downtown hotels are so low that many workers have become dependent on public assistance to survive, proving that the tourism industry has failed to invest in its workforce and assist in revitalizing its diverse local communities. For essentially the same job, hotel and motel workers in Long Beach make less than their counterparts in the region surrounding LAX, downtown LA, Santa Monica, and even Anaheim. The LANE report makes recommendations for both the city of Long Beach and its industrial leadership that include, among other things, safeguards for hotel workers during difficult economic times, affordable health care, and workers' rights to organize. My guest this morning is Jocelyn Coley. She's a lead author of the report and a policy and research analyst for LANE. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you so much for having us here today.
So it's, you know, it sounds like the same old story, government subsidies to industries that don't insist on fair wages and other benefits for workers. And then years after these government subsidies have begun, you find that that workers have not received the kind of benefit that they were promised. I mean, essentially, is this report revealing what your organization thought was a predictable outcome?
Well, sorry, I don't know if we'd say it was a predictable outcome. I think that it's an outcome that's likely to happen when there's not enough transparency, when there's not enough community input, when there's not enough investigation. And yes, that is what we found. We titled this report A Tale of Two Cities because essentially we found that there's two Long Beaches. There's this first down beach that Long Beach that includes this vibrant, revitalized downtown area that's filled with luxury hotels and attractive tourist destinations. And actually, this first Long Beach is listed as one of the top 10 revived downtowns in the United States by the Urban Land Institute. But then we found that there's a second, less discussed Long Beach, which is right around the corner and consists of the surrounding working-class neighborhoods, where poverty is still a really critical issue, and poverty concentration is actually listed as sixth highest in the nation by the Brookings Institution.
So in the city of Long Beach itself?
Yes, in the city of Long Beach itself.
So give us some of those numbers then in terms of how poverty rates compare between Long Beach and the rest of the nation.
Well, right now, we found that more than 18% of Long Beach residents live below the federal poverty line. And the federal poverty line, as you know, is an indicator of extreme poverty. We actually like to use twice the poverty line as an indicator of poverty, which is a more realistic indicator. We also found that more than one in four children in Long Beach, actually about 27%, live below the poverty line. And we found that hotel workers especially are suffering, where hotel wages, the median wage, was around $19,000 a year, which is well below what's been estimated by the Economic Policy Institute and other organizations as necessary to meet basic needs. So that's why we found that in our survey of workers that over 40% of workers utilize one or more forms of public assistance. And actually, half of those workers who rely on public assistance rely on more than one form. So this is another way that the public pays an additional subsidy to the industry, in a manner of speaking.
Hmm. So hundreds of millions of dollars going into the tourist industry. If those hotels, it seems, are treating their workers among the worst, and how much have hotels received, and how do they treat their workers, both in terms of wages and even the right to organize?
Well, we found that the subsidies totaled at least an estimated $114 million to the hotel industry.
Directly, just to the hotel industry.
Yes, it's just directly to the hotel industry. And again, this was a very conservative estimate. And as far as when you also look into what the city has spent into revitalizing its economy, into rebuilding its infrastructure, into creating attractive tourist destinations, building a convention center, then this total comes out to $750 million. So, I mean, I think that's particularly resonant right now in this economic climate when people are really looking at where taxpayer dollars are going, and they're really questioning this. So I think that's really relevant. And when you are giving so much money to an industry and helping this industry out, and I just want to be clear that I don't think anyone is saying that we're against subsidies just, you know, as subsidies, but when you are investing so much in an industry, you're expecting a public benefit to derive from this investment.
Well, these subsidies, do they have specific conditions attached to them that are linked to wages and benefits, et cetera, or are they just going on faith that these industries will in turn pass the benefits down?
Exactly, Sonali.
So they're going on faith.
Yes, and this is what we're this is part of our recommendations, is that we're looking into what types of types of policies that can be passed in order to tie these subsidies to better working conditions for workers, to invest in the communities. Because actually, another really important point is that in our surveys, we found that over 80% of workers were also Long Beach residents. So the workers' economic condition has a direct impact on the city. And this means that these low wages are contributing to poverty in the area, making this an endless cycle.
My guest is Jocelyn Coley, lead author of the report, A Tale of Two Cities, How Long Beach's Investment in Downtown Tourism Has Contributed to Poverty Next Door. She's a policy and research analyst for LANE, the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy. Now, talk about the efforts by the hotel industry to hamper unionizing in these areas in Long Beach, because, of course, unionized workers are less likely to have their salaries eroded.
Yeah, one of the things that our report is calling for is we're calling for the hotels to respect the workers' rights to organize. And this is really critical, and we've had workers come up and workers tell their stories about their working conditions, about the number of rooms that they clean, about whether or not they're receiving their breaks, about what their benefits are. And we're finding that these are simply not enough, that we've had workers that have worked in these hotels for over, 10 years, 20 years, who are still being paid poverty-level wages.
I'm looking at an article from last November where the Hilton in Long Beach was found to be intimidating hotel workers, and there were charges filed with the National Labor Relations Board by Unite Here Local 11.
Yes, and those charges are still pending, and so they're still under investigation by the National Labor Relations Board, and we're pretty confident that we'll be successful on those charges.
And but can you talk also in the last couple of minutes, Jocelyn, about the demographics of the workers involved? I understand that a significant number of the workers are from the Philippines or have Filipino ancestry?
Yes, exactly. This is what makes Long Beach a really interesting city, is that it's a very diverse city, that this isn't an issue that someone can say, well, this is just a Latino issue, or this is just a Filipino issue, or this is just an African-American issue, because this affects all communities in Long Beach.
And primarily people of color.
Yeah, and primarily people of color. It's a large immigrant population as well, but it's very diverse within those areas. So
in terms of your recommendations, we mentioned one, which is tying the subsidies to direct benefits to workers. But what else do you recommend, and where can listeners find out more about your report?
We're proposing several actions for Long Beach city leaders. We're recommending that the city conduct a full audit of all of its hotel leases and redevelopment agreements. We're also urging the hotel hold city hearings on the costs and benefits of the tourism industry to Long Beach residents. And we've actually gained a lot of political support for this, that there was a recent article in the District Weekly where many elected officials came out in support of this. We're also recommending that the city require a community benefits review and explore policy options for raising standards at hotels and ensuring community benefits. We're also calling on the industry to provide safeguards to hotel workers during these difficult economic times. We're calling on the hotel to provide, good wages, good sustainable wages, and affordable health insurance so that workers aren't relying on public assistance and second jobs in order to meet their basic needs.
And does Lane have a website?
Yes, actually, this report was commissioned on behalf of the Long Beach Coalition for Good Jobs and a Healthy Community, and I strongly encourage listeners to please go to www.goodjobslongbeach.org, and there they can download the whole report, and since it's a very lengthy report, they can also download just the executive summary. They can read worker stories, and they can join our mailing list.
That's goodjobslongbeach.org?
Yes.
Well, Jocelyn, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us, Sonali.
Jocelyn Coley is lead author of the report, A Tale of Two Cities, How Long Beach's Investment in Downtown Tourism Has Contributed to Poverty Next Door. We'll link to it from our website, kpfk.org/uprising, later today. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Bill Bryson once said, the whole of the global economy is based on supplying the cravings of 2% of the world's population. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer, Jesse Wood is our intern, and Jazz Shepherd is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this program after 10 a.m. today on our website, kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening, and see you tomorrow at 8 on day 1 of our Winter Fun Drive. Still